So we'll be looking to see what those numbers come back as, because certainly as we see the numbers growing strictly in the unsheltered, we have questions in terms of what that looks like. And Lorraine mentioned youth, and certainly we know that Indigenous representation in care, youth in the care system, the foster care system, is disproportionately high, higher than 50% or in the airboat. So as individuals age out of care, that becomes a huge factor in terms of homelessness. So we'll be looking at those numbers when we get them in the fall to dig down and see what that looks like and see how that's hitting in Indigenous communities. Certainly, we know that historically, homelessness has hit men more than women, but we're seeing an increase in representation amongst women in homelessness. And so that's something we also want to, as we get the data, look into in terms of its impact, in terms of families, in terms of that sort of separation. So I think, you know, we have this initial report. It's flagging things. Certainly the biggest thing, as Laura mentioned, is the simple fact that we've grown by 9%. The fact that our unsheltered count has grown by 30%. Those are the starting points that are heading in the wrong direction. And now the work in front of us is to get the full report and be able to look at that city by city and by different considerations. So I think I'll leave it there for now. Any questions? Thank you.
9%, big increase. Can you speak to the action you'd like government to take here to address this issue?
I think the most important action on the part of government is an ongoing commitment to actually working on this issue. The federal government funded this count and understands the numbers, and had previously made a commitment to reduce chronic homelessness by 50%. So taking the numbers seriously across all levels of government is key, and then a lot of it is the housing market, and the actual affordable housing has been lagging. There's huge concerted effort to fill in that gap, but in some ways, changes in housing programs years ago have created some of the complexities and problems we're seeing today. So we just have to get behind it. I think the other piece to really recognize is homelessness isn't just a housing problem, although it's what solves the problem. It's the supports and even the community acceptance and caring that comes with this issue is critical to how you solve it. It's the outreach as well. And it's just making sure that we look at everyone who is living on the streets today with their story and know that they deserve a home.
You mentioned that there was a significant growth we're seeing in outlying districts in the region. Many of those communities don't maybe have appropriate services. Would you envision some kind of regional support system, or what might we be able to do to make sure that, you know, this is a widespread issue? And what do we need to do to make sure that those services are available wherever they're needed?
I think your point is a really good point, that in a way, at one point, I used to be the housing planner for Metro Vancouver, and this is definitely a regional issue. I also see that when I work with people who have lived experience of homelessness, they move to where they think the housing is affordable, but they really don't have enough income to stay in that housing. So I think, in a way, when I look at the patterns, I understand that people are making the best choices that they can, that the housing market is actually a regional issue, that is affordability across the region is an issue. And then I think it is looking at that concerted partnership, like the regional work we're doing here through the Community Advisory Board, to solve this issue one community, one region at a time.
Just to confirm, so I know you said here that unsheltered homelessness doubled in one municipality. Based on looking at the numbers, is that delta?
And so again, I always look at both the absolute number increase and then the percentage. And so delta was always one. We had understood there's homelessness all across the region, but suddenly you're seeing a way higher number in that area. The report in September that will be produced will provide a more complete picture. But in my mind, I think often, again, I'm looking at people go where they think the rent's going to be more affordable, and then it's not more affordable. It could also be other factors, and that's where the voice of lived expertise is so important to really understand what that is. My own work in this area used to look at it like economies of the makeshift, that people do the best that they can with what they have, but sometimes it's not enough, and especially in a housing market like what we have here in the region. So I think Delta is just the same as the other parts of the region that way.
And there's a lot of talk and focus on homelessness in Vancouver itself and sort of awareness of it, but people in sort of surrounding municipalities might be surprised by the increase in the number, but that also might, I guess, reflect what they're witnessing. What would you say to people who are in some of these outlying communities that are maybe surprised by the numbers of people?
I think in my mind, I'm starting to hear, and you'd have to talk to each local government in a way, but I'm starting to hear more people talk about it as a crisis. Whereas before, we understood that there were things that needed to be done and investments that needed to be made. But because of the affordability crisis that is across the region, the lack of affordable housing in some communities or other kinds of supports, I think most will now recognize that this is a crisis and that it needs all levels of government to really make a commitment to do what they can to end the crisis.
Yeah, you mentioned youth aging out of care and sort of into homelessness. Can you speak a bit about that? Like, is that a... And that's very troubling. I mean, that's just deeply troubling. Can you give me a sense of how, I guess, unusual that is? Or do we have trends to see that it's increasing, decreasing? What does that look like?
I think the deeper September report can say more about that for sure. But I also know that the Indigenous community has put a lot of depth and effort into understanding. So I'm going to suggest David may have insight there to also share.
Thanks, Lauren. It's long been an issue. The aging out of care. I know there's been a lot of commentary from different levels of government in recent years around what that looks like. But the numbers are what the numbers are. And it's an ongoing issue that we want to look at because certainly from the Indigenous community, we know that there's such a hugely disproportionate number of those kids in care who are Indigenous. And they come out of care, they're residential school survivors, often disconnects with their community. So there's not a community for them to often connect and go back to. And they're left exposed of the system and streets. And having access to housing, to education, all those things are the key things. And, you know, there's been a lot of interest and attention looked at that, but not necessarily... It hasn't translated yet in terms of what we want to see in terms of that outcome for youth in care. So I think, as Laurie mentioned, the report in September, I want to look into it in more detail and sort of dig in there and see how that looks for Indigenous youth.
Thank you.
Just on the topic of the full report and the preliminary report, what's the sort of thought process around releasing these preliminary findings now as opposed to just waiting for the full report to come?
Simply the fact that it grew 9% over the past 2 years, it came to us that this is something that you know, every time we have a chance to speak to it, we're going to speak to it. And so to put this in front and come back to it and dig into it more deeply, we felt this was valuable because it keeps it on top in people's minds. You know, and that's really the primary reason. We had this data. If it said something different, maybe we would have waited till the fall. But seeing a 9% increase, seeing it all in unsheltered, we felt it was important just to bring this forward and say, this is what we're seeing, stay tuned, because we're going to have more, and it will be more illuminating as we get that data.
So, as David said, the full report will be out in September, with more sort of region by region and more specifically broken down demographic information. The preliminary report already has a whole bunch of really interesting and, frankly, disappointing stats about the rise of homelessness here in Vancouver and the surrounding areas. You can find that report by searching 2025 point-in-time homelessness count in Greater Vancouver or by going to the Homelessness Services Association of BC's website, hsa-bc.ca. And we're going to have one, maybe two more stories for you here on Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby right after this.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures, public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
Welcome back to Speak Up here on CJSF. Please come volunteer with us. Come by the sub 1420 and make radio or do any number of other things radio related or otherwise. Up next on the show, a few months ago, I spoke with Dr. Teal Phelps Bondaroff, who we heard earlier this hour in his capacity as a spokesperson for Access BC. I previously spoke to him about his role as a sea cucumber and marine crime expert, as he spoke about the release of a paper he co-authored about sea cucumber crime in Canada and in BC in particular. That was a really great conversation, which you can find at cjsf.ca if you want to get into the real nitty-gritty. In that conversation, we mentioned a case right here in BC featuring Scott Steer, who is a notorious sea criminal. We were hoping in that to hear news soon afterwards of his sentencing. And it took a while, but that news came out just this past week. So I got in touch with Teal to talk about that, about the ramifications of the sentencing, and to just give you a bit of an update. And of course, if you did not hear the previous story, Teal does a good job of wrapping it up and presenting all the context. So without any further ado, let's get to that.
So I'm Dr. Teal Phelps Bondaroff, him. I am the Director of Research for Oceans Asia. We are a marine conservation organization that works to combat illegal fishing. And our focus of late has been a lot of work on shark fins. And we had a paper come out recently on seahorses. And one of my areas of expertise is crime in sea cucumber fisheries. I think I can humbly say that I am one of the world leading experts in sea cucumber wildlife crime. There's only about 8 of us, and a couple of them are my old research assistants, but it's exploring people who are engaging in illegal activities within fisheries relating to sea cucumbers. And what I found with my work, which I think is quite interesting, is we find crime at every stage of the fishery supply chain, from people forging fisheries documents to people fishing legally out of season in illegal areas with illegal gear, using human rights violations on vessels, forging papers, smuggling sea cucumbers, lying about places of origin, etc. And one of the fascinating things is I've been looking at sea cucumber crime around the world, and a lot of my work is focused on a couple of hotspots. India and Sri Lanka is a major hotspot. Mexico is another one, the Galapagos. And recently, our research team has been looking at sea cucumber crime here in Canada. And we had a paper come out earlier this year that found that there weren't a lot of major cases in Canadian history. You've got mostly small administrative cases dealing with people who forgot their licenses on the day of. And the largest fine in Canadian sea cucumber crime prior to this recent story was $21,300 with no jail time for someone who was engaging in some, criminal activity around sea cucumbers. But typically they're administrative crimes, which throws this current case into stark contrast. Today we are talking about the largest sea cucumber crime case in Canadian history, and it's a pleasure to talk to you, Jesse.
Yeah, thanks for being here with me, Teal. We have spoken previously, and if people want to really get into the nitty-gritty of what is sea cucumber crime and that sort of global holistic perspective, you can go to cjsf.ca. The episode is posted there. But as you mentioned, there is a local BC case that is making news because the sentencing was just announced. And as you sort of foreshadowed, it sets a new mark in terms of the level of fines and the consequences for sea cucumber crime.
Yes. And so this case is a case involving a gentleman named Scott Steer, who is a notorious poacher. And I didn't realize this until I was reading the court filings, but apparently he has the longest record of Fisheries Act violations in Canadian history. And this is a man that since 2008 has been on the radar of the authorities. Fisheries and Oceans Canada opened a file on him in 2008. They've opened 15 different files. And since that time, he's had 34 convictions in 13 prior cases. And these are everything from crab fishing to other fisheries violations. There was issues around illegal harvesting, issues around defrauding other vessel owners. There's probation violations and a whole host of crimes. And this is quite an interesting and high seas adventure story. The background is in March 2020. Some folks on a ferry saw a boat without its lights on fishing at night. They reported it to DFO. DFO gave chase in a high-speed sea chase. Someone, Scott Steer, threw his cell phone off the side of the boat with all the evidence in it. Divers 3 days later went down, retrieved the phone, and were able to recover information about his criminal enterprises, and they charged him on 8 counts of various violations of the Fisheries Act and violating previous prohibitions. Just to underscore how notorious this gentleman was, he was prohibited from stepping on a fishing boat until 2038. So one of the crimes that he committed was violating that prohibition. But now we finally had the sentencing this past Friday in Nanaimo, and the sentencing was significant. You know, in the past, he's received small fines and some short jail sentences. The sentencing was 6 years in prison and a $1.1 million fine. So it's very significant in that way. And what was really interesting was some of the wording from the judge. You know, the judge said at one point that they need to move him as far away from the sea for as long a period as possible, and that only incarceration will prevent him from inflicting further harm on the scarce public resource of the fisheries. This is someone who's unrepentant, who was actively fishing illegally and selling illegal fish products during his trial. And so, yes, we do have sentencing in this case, and it's quite a significant punishment.
What does it mean to you as someone who is sort of invested in the topic of marine wildlife crime to see this level of punishment?
Well, it's really, you know, gratifying, because far too often the punishment is really a small fine, and that's just worked into the cost of doing business. You see ships coming ashore with millions of dollars of illegally caught fish in their holds, which they then can sell and make a profit, and their fine is less than the cost of fueling the vessel. I will say that the jail sentence is significant. I would have liked to see higher fines, only because his company was selling illegal sea cucumbers to the tune of $1 million. So I would have liked to see even greater fines that were more punitive, but really this is a significant series of fines, and this is what the prosecution was asking for. So it's nice to see that the court was really listening and saying, no, this is what's needed to protect our oceans. But yeah, far too often the punishments really do just become, you know, the cost of doing business, and that really undermines governance on the high seas. One of the reasons I think that is largely because we treat crime targeting the environment, and specifically the ocean, often as an administrative crime. Slap on the wrist. Ah, boys will be boys. And it's often always boys, of course. There's a very gendered nature to sea cucumber fisheries. But these are crimes, right? If someone was stealing $1 million of lumber or from a bank or from a local business, that would be a very significant crime. But this happens on a regular basis at sea, and people are simply given a slap on the wrist. Well, here we see a case where that's no longer the case. And here's someone getting serious jail time for having a dramatic impact on our oceans.
So do you hope that future potential sea cucumber criminals or sea wildlife criminals will see this verdict, the sentencing, and maybe pause?
I hope so. I mean, one can hope, right? When you follow the judgment, the judge did not seem very convinced that this sentence would have an effect on Mr. Steer's behavior. As you said, he's been unrepentant and continually poaching time and time again. But my hope is that anyone else looking at the sentence will kind of raise an eyebrow before they consider, you know, stealing marine resources and damaging our oceans. And I will say that out here on the West Coast, you know, from our research, we haven't found as many cases. This is an outlier. Most of the cases are administrative. Out on the East Coast, it was often people who forgot their license on the day of, and that's a small fine. And they just need to produce their license. So we have a relatively well-regulated fishery. But one of the challenges we have as researchers and investigators is we don't know if we're not seeing cases reported in the news and being, you know, picked up by the law enforcement authorities, whether that's because there aren't any cases or because the criminals are being very shifty and effectively hiding their operations. So it's always one of the challenges in our business. But these are global networks as well. So the sea cucumbers aren't being sold here in Canada. They're moving through Canada, but they're ultimately heading off to Southeast Asia. And we see globally, you know, fishers sending, you know, and middlemen sending, you know, sea wildlife products to places like Changwon in Hong Kong. And that's, you know, there's a global network. And one of the big risks that we see in other jurisdictions is what's called serial exploitation, where fishers will exploit one area, devastate it, and then move on to the next. And that has a devastating effect. So my hope is that this has a stifling effect on anyone considering poaching sea cucumbers and other marine wildlife, for that matter, out here on the West Coast, because we don't want to see people just moving on to slightly, you know, more prolific pastures where there's less law enforcement and then impacting our oceans.
Right, and you've sort of touched on this in your previous answers, but obviously someone facing criminal consequences for this criminal behavior is good, but what would be better would be just sort of preventing the crime in the first place. In your opinion, what needs to be done to make strides in that area?
That's a really good question, and I think it just relates to ongoing enforcement and monitoring and governance. Out here in Canada, we have relatively good governance, as I mentioned, so I think that's quite reassuring. But I think the international supply chains is where I'd like to see a lot more action. One of the big risks that we see is something called fish laundering, where people introduce illegally caught fish from one market into another, where they're then laundered to become legal products, using air quotes here for the radio purposes. And that's a huge problem. And so you can actually see products like those that Scott Steer was stealing from our oceans can be introduced into legal markets through these different fish laundering tactics. And so that's something I'd like to see more work on. And the other one is international cooperation. Our work looks at these international networks, and we often find, not here in Canada, less so, but in other jurisdictions, the people most being arrested are poor fishers, not Mr. Steer in this case, but they're poor fishers, and the middlemen and the endpoint sellers who are making all the money aren't the ones that are being arrested. So one thing I'd like to see law enforcement do is a lot of international cooperation to wind up these networks, because the real risk is that you arrest, you know, poor fishers, and the middlemen and the buyers just find other poor fishers to exploit, and they continue their operation. It's the middlemen and, you know, the people who are the kingpins in these networks that need to be taken down, and that involves international cooperation because it is transnational trade.
And is there anything else you think people should know, either about this case or about sea cucumber crime or marine wildlife crime in general?
I think there's a lot. I mean, I've literally written the book chapter on this topic. So if folks are interested, please go check that out. But to me, it's the importance of understanding that wildlife crime targets a wide range of species. I think when a lot of people think of wildlife crime, they think of elephants and tigers and, you know, charismatic megafauna, typically terrestrial, sometimes sharks, dolphins, seals, and those kinds of things. But what they don't realize is there is a vast global market for what I guess you would call obscure species, whether it's sea cucumbers or caterpillar fungus or seahorses or bear bile, a whole wide range of wildlife products that people haven't even heard of. And one of the risks that happens there is that people haven't heard of these products, and so they're more easy to transport across borders. Border security is looking out for guns, drugs, people, and, you know, well-known wildlife products, but they're not looking out for a suitcase full of fish maw or a swim bladder. And a suitcase full of fish maw can be worth $1 million. And so there's a lot of opportunities for law enforcement to step up their efforts to combat these less well-known species. And it's really important that they do, because what we're beginning to see is a lot of organized crime syndicates are diversifying their portfolios into wildlife crime. When we were looking at crime and sea cucumber fisheries in Mexico, we found cases where sea cucumbers were found alongside drugs. And our worry is that you see things like narco ranching, where illicit crime networks are investing heavily in these wildlife products as a way of moving large amounts of money across borders and as a way of diversifying their portfolios. And that's a huge risk. But I will say this much, the people who are engaged in a lot of wildlife crime of this nature aren't often as smart as the criminals who are smuggling guns, drugs, and people. And as a result, it's often easier to wind up their networks. They're not as security conscious. So it's an opportunity for law enforcement as well. So I think we really need to be aware of the breadth of species that are targeted by wildlife trafficking and step up to do something about it.
Great. Thank you for joining me today.
Well, always a pleasure chatting.
That was my conversation with Dr. Teal Phelps Bondaroff about sea cucumber crime, marine crime, and the recent sentencing of Scott Steer and his wife Melissa in their huge sea cucumber crime ring. For more information about Oceans Asia, the advocacy group that Teal is a part of, you can go to oceansasia.org. And to find more about Teal, he does a whole lot of advocacy on a whole lot of issues, both sort of marine biology and science related, as we heard earlier in the show, access to prescription contraceptives. He does work on the presence of prayer in civic municipal politics. He's a politician on the island. So lots of things that he's involved with. You can go to teale.ca. That's teale.ca. I did promise at the top of the show that we'd be hearing a piece from Danny Nesvedrani, our local community journalist here at CJSF, but I talked and played too much of my own stuff, so that's not going to happen. So instead, I'm going to plug his show, which is coming up later tonight. It is called Analog Archives. It happens after the art show at 6 p.m., and it features him diving through our station's 90,000-plus item archive of music, things that have been submitted to the station. And yesterday, when I was down at our downtown studio, where I interviewed Dr. Phelps Bondaroff, I also went digging through our extended archive, which is down there, for a CD that he was looking for a future episode. While I was down there, I stumbled across the fantastic record Sorcerer by Miles Davis, which is playing in the background right now. This is Mascualero. And so I just thought I'd play this out as a sort of promo for Danny's show, which is also featuring things found in the archives, analog archives, Thursdays at 6 p.m. Check it out. Thursday nights are awesome here at the station. Well, all day Thursday. We got Your Shoes Untied at 2, we got Free Voices at 3, we got The Art Show at 5. It just keeps going. It's great. Stay tuned here to CJSF. Democracy Now! Is up next, and we'll just let you listen to some Miles Davis, along with Wayne Shorter, Ron Carter, Tony Williams, and Herbie Hancock, Mascualero, from Sorcerer. I'll see you next time.